the bed. He explored the pocket with his hand and quickly recognized that the intruder was a plastic pen with a sheet of paper wrapped around it. Jimmy looked at his fellow adventurers. Tyler and Gary were going about their business, but Philip was glancing in his direction. Jimmy made eye contact with Philip and slowly withdrew his hand from his pocket. Philip seemed satisfied and went back to putting his bedding away. After an interval of time, Jimmy had calculated to not be suspicious. He announced that he was going to go void his bowels. He didn't usually proclaim his intent to defecate so proudly, but he figured it was the most effective way possible to ensure that Todd would not want to watch him. Once he was out in the woods alone, Jimmy unrolled the note.
"This is good," he thought. "Philip wants to conspire, and he came to me. That shows some trust. I'm making progress."
He still held the note close to his chest and made an effort to conceal his actions in case he had misjudged Todd's proclivities. Jimmy read,
"Todd is probably watching and listening. After we make the weapon, next stop is Chasm of Certain Doom. We need a plan. T.
Agreed. Ideas? P.
My first idea was to ask you. That was a dead end. Second idea, ask Gary? T.
T, no need for snark. G, how about it? Any ideas? P.
You two want a sneaky plan and you haven't asked J? Dumb. G.
J. P.
Jimmy shook his head as he rolled the note around the pen and stowed them both in his pocket. The wizards gathered as much water as they could, compared ideas as to how to transport the blade, and agreed that the best method they had was carefully, with lots of rags wrapped around their hands, while shouting instructions and insults at each other. They also agreed that this was a bitter disappointment. They followed the path out of town, which was not marked, but there were only two paths, in or out of town, so they chose the path that had not brought them in. The path was wide, more of a road, really, and was mostly downhill, but the going was slow, and they rotated their place in formation often. They positioned the blade so that the twisted portion was at the front, so whoever carried that portion could support it with one hand while walking almost fully forward, watching the path ahead for obstacles and wolves. The two supporting the sides of the blade walked sideways, more to control the blade than to support its weight. The man at the back had the easiest job, in that he got to walk straight ahead, but he also had the most dangerous job. His view of the path was obscured by the blade and his fellow blade carriers, and if there was a mishap, the others might lose a finger, while he could very well get decapitated or cut in half. It did not take long for the lush forest, with its evergreen trees, thick undergrowth, and abundant tree wolves, to start thinning. They knew soon it would give way to some form of desert, which meant a bleak landscape, no shade, and, they'd been warned, sand wolves.
"What was that other thing you warned us about?"
Philip asked, walking sideways, both hands supporting the shining blade. Jimmy, who was in the lead position, looked back and said,
"He called it the dreaded elemental, whatever that means."
Gary, bringing up the rear, yelped,
"Eyes forward!"
Tyler said,
"An elemental is a fairly common type of monster in fantasy stories and D&D adventures. They're supposed to be made of one of the four elements, earth, wind, fire, or water. It's almost always fire, because why wouldn't it be?"
"Maybe it'll be the fifth element," Gary said, "the supreme being."
Tyler saw the confusion on Philip's face and explained,
"It's from a movie."
Tyler affected a high-pitched voice and a foreign accent and said to Gary,
"Lilu Dallas, Multipass."
He turned back to Philip and said,
"In the movie, the fifth element was a beautiful woman who wore nothing but suspenders and an ace bandage. We will not be so lucky."
Philip said,
"Marvelous. What else do we know about it?"
Jimmy glanced back.
"He said the dreaded elemental, so we know that it's an elemental, and we know that it is dreaded."
"Eyes forward!"
Gary shouted.
"The dreaded elemental,"
Philip said bitterly.
"Doesn't tell us much. We already know it's dreaded. We're the ones dreading it.
Jimmy shouted back without turning his head.
Sorry I keep turning around, Gary. I'm not doing it on purpose.
Gary said,
Yeah, I know. Just try to remember, okay? Seriously, guys, I don't know how much of this I can take.
Philip thought,
I don't know how much of this any of us would be able to take. I just wish there had been a better way to carry this cursed thing. Of course there wasn't, though. Todd's too clever for that.
Philip mulled that last part over a bit.
Todd's too clever. That doesn't sound right. Maybe...
He considered suggesting that they put the blade down and run back to town to see if there was something they had overlooked, but dismissed the thought.
No. If there'd been something there we could have used, we'd have remembered it. We're too smart to have missed anything.
Philip mulled that over and thought,
Ew, that doesn't sound quite right either.
23.
Looks like there's a town around the bend,
Roy shouted back to the rest of his group. Gwen was carrying the front of the litter. She nodded back over her shoulder to Martin at the back of the litter and said,
Town ahead.
Martin said, Got it. He lifted the poles from his shoulders and turned to look at Britt. She nodded, sending the clear message that she'd heard, so he put the weight back on his shoulders without saying anything. During the hike from the home of what Martin had learned not to ever call the Gwenches, they had taken to having the person walking in the lead keep a bit of distance out ahead of the rest of the group. That way they could warn of any obstacles in their path, and often, if they were attacked by tree wolves, the lead had them dealt with before the rest of the group caught up. Roy waited for the others. He felt it would be better if they entered the town together.
This would be Beaumore, I think, Gwen said. We're supposed to make the Dialowine into some kind of weapon here, if I remember right.
They entered the small town cautiously, Roy still in the lead. There were unconvincing citizens ambling aimlessly around the street. A clearly artificial old woman appeared to be making bread. There was some sort of motion in a shop up ahead. Roy approached the woman, who was repetitively kneading her dough.
Hello,
Roy said. The woman said,
How can ye not know where ye are? This she be the town of Beaumore.
Roy walked back to the group, who heard the exchange and needed no explanation. Roy squinted into the distance and said,
I guess we head to the shop.
Gwen said,
Probably a blacksmith. Makes sense.
As they walked through the empty streets of the fake town, Martin saw that tucked between two of the huts, there was an old ox cart. He pointed and said,
We could have used that.
Britt glanced at the cart and said,
We don't have anything to pull it, but yeah, I bet a couple of people could make good headway on level ground. Oh well, we'll see if we end up having to carry anything out of here. That might come in handy.
When they reached the shop, Gwen and Martin heaved the heavy litter to the ground with an air of finality. The shop was an open-air affair, with an awning to keep the weather off and a fence to keep the pedestrians out. There was a forge that looked like a pile of bricks, and a blacksmith who also looked like a pile of bricks. There were various nails, horseshoes, hammers, and other products or tools of the blacksmithing trade strewn around the shop. The blacksmith was using his tools to assert his will over a glowing bar of metal, fresh from the forge. Britt stepped toward the blacksmith and said,
Hi.
The blacksmith turned and said,
Greetings, stranger. How does this day find you?
Britt shrugged and said, The blacksmith put down his work. He walked over to a basin of stagnant water where he washed, or at least rinsed, his hands. Then he introduced himself.
I am Inchgower, skilled blacksmith and crafter of fine weapons.
Britt said, Uh-huh. The blacksmith listened intently, nodding and stroking his chin. After a stretch of awkward silence, he said,
Aye, 'tis a long journey to be sure. I'm certain you didn't come all this way without good reason.
Britt made a hurry-it-up motion with her hand and said, Uh-huh. Inchgower spread his hands apologetically.
I see. You've come to the right place, but sadly, I cannot help you.
Martin said, No?
I know all about the prophecy,
the blacksmith explained.
But to make the weapon you need, I require certain raw materials. Materials that have not been available for quite some time, I'm afraid.
Britt pointed at the litter with the invisible chunk of rock wrapped in Martin's old robe. She stood there silently for a moment before Roy said,
I guess they do just wait for a verbal cue before continuing.
A look of amazement filled the blacksmith's face. He dropped the rag he'd been holding and staggered to the gate, where he looked down at the round lump that could really have been anything wrapped in a bolt of dirty sequined cloth.
You have it?
He gasped.
You managed to procure the Dylowine. I cannot believe it.
Britt said, uh-huh. Inchgower looked delighted. He said,
Gentlemen, I will make you your weapon.
Britt turned to Gwen and motioned for her to take a turn. Gwen bowed slightly to her, then said,
Yeah?
The blacksmith turned to face Gwen, bolted forward 3 steps, seized her by the shoulders, and said,
We will need bricks! Lots of bricks, my friends! Come with me! There are wheelbarrows out back!
Britt cringed.
Eesh! Sorry about that, Gwen. I didn't know he'd do that.
Inchgower let go of Gwen and strode purposefully out the rear of the shop. Martin said,
I think he's waiting for us to go get the wheelbarrows.
Let him wait,
Roy said, rubbing his hands together. He glanced at Britt and said,
That went really well, didn't it?
She smiled and nodded. Roy turned to Martin and Gwen and said,
Just to make sure we're all on the same page here. At each stop in this stupid quest, we're supposed to do something, right? But at the last stop, with all the Gwens, we didn't, did we?
No, we did not, Martin said.
Right, Britt said, taking over from Roy. So when the blacksmith started into his subroutine, it proved that we don't actually have to do any of this crap, which is good because we need to catch up to the others. Now we know we can.
The whole point of coming here had been to meet up with their friends and offer them assistance. It had weighed on all of their minds that they didn't feel like they were making any progress in catching up to the first group. Of course, due to the other group's extended stay with Inchgower, they had gained a great deal of ground, but they had no way of knowing that.
So you're saying we should just move on? Martin said.
Unless you like the idea of staying here and gathering bricks,
Roy answered. Martin said,
No, but he's supposed to make us a weapon. What if later we need it? Whatever it is, to move forward.
Roy turned to Britt and said,
The boy makes a good point.
Britt said,
Yeah, but if we stay here and do whatever it is we're supposed to, it'll be that much harder to catch up with the others. If, on the other hand, we skip this and make tracks as fast as we can and catch up, they'll have the weapon and we won't need ours.
What if we never catch up?
Martin asked.
Then we can backtrack and get the weapon, because if that happens, we have much bigger problems than making good time. Look, I know that leaving without whatever we're supposed to get here is taking a chance, but we have to stay focused on what our real goals are. We didn't come here to experience this quest. We came here to help our friends, and we aren't accomplishing that following at a distance. We need to catch up to them.
Martin raised both hands, signaling partial defeat.
I'm not arguing with that. I'm just trying to think ahead for once. I don't want us to get stuck here because we don't have some object we need later.
Britt smiled.
No, you're right. That's a good point. But we need to catch up, and that won't happen unless we start taking some risks. Besides, Martin, this isn't really much of a risk. We know we won't get stuck here, because if we did, Britt the Elder wouldn't be in Atlantis right now. She'd be here with us. Of course, she might still be here with us right now, and we get her out so she can be in Atlantis now, too. But even if that's the case, we still get out, because if we have the ability to get her out, that suggests we can get ourselves out as well.
Martin said,
I can't argue with that. Or even follow it, really.
Roy said,
Good. I say we look around the place, see if there's anything we can use, then get on our way.
Gwen found the water pump and refilled their bottles. Aside from that, there was little of any use, or so it seemed at first. When they regrouped to leave and got a good look at the path out of town, Roy asked everyone to wait for a moment. The path was nice and wide. The ground was dry and solid. They'd been walking downhill for most of their journey, and the terrain didn't give them reason to expect a change.
I think I have an idea,
Roy said.
I know we need to get a move on, but like the lady says, it's time to take some risks, and this might be worth it.
Roy turned and walked back toward town. Martin followed, asking Roy for details. As the men disappeared around the side of the blacksmith shop, Gwen heard Roy ask,
"Do kids still play with radio flyer wagons when you were a boy?"
Martin answered,
"Yeah, big red plastic things, right?"
Britt stared down the path, as if trying to peer into the future. She muttered some words that were largely unintelligible. Gwen picked out, "Enough water," and "wolf jerky to eat." Britt stopped mumbling when she became aware that Gwen was smirking at her.
"Why are you smirking at me?"
Britt asked.
"Was I?"
Gwen asked, smirking.
"Yes, you still are,"
Gwen said.
"You must be really worried about Philip,"
Britt said.
"And that's why you're smiling. You know, Gwen, I can see why Martin finds you confusing. You must be really worried about Philip, because when people are really deeply concerned, their true thoughts tend to come out."
"And?"
"And,"
Gwen said,
"you're using the fact that Britt the Elder is back in Atlantis as proof that we can get out of here without whatever it is we were supposed to make at this stop."
Britt saw what Gwen was getting at. When Britt first traveled to the distant past and found the version of Atlantis she'd imagined building already there waiting for her, along with another woman who looked exactly like her and claimed to be her from the future and to have built the city she'd wanted to build as a gift for her, Britt's natural first reaction had been to become very, very confused. Her natural second reaction was to be deeply suspicious of the second Britt. As time went on, and the other her seemed to remember everything she said, did, or thought, and did or claimed to have done everything Britt aspired to, Britt's natural third reaction was to wallow in resignation and resentment. And that's exactly what she did for years, until Philip came along. Philip had two core beliefs, that the 1980s were the pinnacle of human culture, and that people can always change their destiny. Britt liked his second core belief so much that she was willing to ignore how obviously wrong his first core belief was. Philip had looked at the massive pile of convincing evidence that Britt the Elder was Britt the Younger's future, and he said, "Nah." He immediately constructed an elaborate theory for how Britt the Elder was a projection created in real time based on estimates of the possible outcomes of Britt the Younger's actions. Thus, Britt the Elder wasn't living Britt the Younger's future. Britt the Younger was altering Britt the Elder's present. Britt, both Britts, oddly, loved him for that. Since the day she'd met Philip, Britt the Younger had refused to be pinned down on the issue of whether Britt the Elder was in fact her. If Philip was around, she'd sit in silence, smiling, as he explained that she was not. If Britt the Elder was present, Britt the Younger would sit in silence, sulking, while the Elder explained that she was. If both Philip and the Elder were in the room when the question came up, everybody else would sit in silence and watch the always entertaining debate that would ensue. Now, neither of them was present. Britt was on her own, and Gwen had clearly been paying attention, waiting for her to take a position on the Britt the Elder question.
"It's just interesting to know that when it comes down to it, you believe Britt the Elder is you,"
Gwen said.
"Eh,"
Britt shrugged.
"When it suits me."
"What's that supposed to mean?"
Gwen asked. Britt was not displeased to see that Gwen's smirk was gone.
"Look, when that person you all call Britt the Elder is pretending to be humble and gracious while accepting praise and credit for my ideas, I tell myself that she can't possibly be me, because I'd never do that to someone."
Gwen said,
"I can understand that. But that's not what's happening right now, is it? Right now, I'm wearing a warm coat she warned me to bring, carrying a backpack she sent, drinking from water bottles she provided. That's her being helpful. That's her doing something right."
Gwen nodded.
"And you want to believe you would do that in her place?"
"No,"
Britt said.
"If she's just me in the future, that means I'm the one who helped us, and I like that. She steals my credit all the time. This is a way I can take some of hers."
24.
"What do you guys picture when you hear the word desert?"
Philip asked.
"Sand dunes," Tyler said. A sea of stark, clean, undulating sand dunes, receding endlessly into the horizon under a clear blue sky.
They walked for a moment. Then Philip asked,
"You're thinking about the movie Dune now, aren't you, Tyler?"
"Yes. Yes, I am."
Jimmy said, "I picture salt flats, like Bonneville. Just a flat, lifeless plain. No landmarks, no features, nothing but salt and sand and heat."
Gary said,
"I picture an island with some ferns and a single palm tree. And before you say anything, yes, I know that's not right. That's pretty much the opposite of a desert. But when I was a kid, they always called that a desert island, and it just stuck with me, okay?"
Jimmy said,
"That's fine, Gary. Everybody has that kind of stuff. When you think of a punk rocker, you probably picture a leather jacket and a mohawk. But two of the biggest punk bands were the Talking Heads and Blondie."
"My point is," Philip said, "when you hear the word desert, nobody pictures this."
"No," Tyler agreed. "It might qualify as a desert, but they should probably call it a wasteland."
The path down the foothills and out of the woods had been wide and mostly downhill, before terminating in the desert they'd been told was called the Scapa. And as Philip had said, the Scapa was not what they were expecting. They expected to find sand, but they found dirt. Gritty, dark red dirt. They expected a near-total lack of life, maybe punctuated with the occasional cactus. But they found plentiful tumbleweeds and occasional glimpses of tiny, fast-moving rodents. They expected to find no water, but it clearly had rained at some point in the recent past. They would occasionally pass a patch of damp ground, or a puddle of liquid that, if you were being a stickler, you would have to admit was water. But only someone who wanted to die, or was desperate to live, would dare drink it. In short, where most deserts were hostile to life, the Scapa was merely passive-aggressive. Where the Sahara seemed to scream at people to stay away, the Scapa told them, "You want to live here? Go ahead, fine by me. I've given you everything you need. Plants, animals, water. Flourish, why don't you?" Rather than being perfectly flat or covered with treacherous but beautiful dunes, the landscape was made up of rolling hills that were just steep enough to be irritating to walk up and treacherous to walk down, and just flat enough to be boring. The wizards had to put in effort and watch their step, but only because they were hand-carrying an object that had been designed solely for the purpose of cutting their hands. One advantage of the gently rolling landscape and the scratchy, skeletal nature of the sagebrush was that they could see the sandwolves coming a mile away. Or at least they would have if the sandwolf simulation subroutine had been more realistic. As it was, they could see the sandwolves render out of thin air from yards away. When a sandwolf appeared, whoever was carrying the twisted portion of the Mobius blade would let go and dispatch the wolf. Much like they had with the sledge, they took turns fending off wolves and settled into a nice routine, which experience had taught them is exactly when things go wrong. Philip was on wolf duty, pinching the twisted portion of the Mobius blade off to his side with his hand while walking forward. The others concentrated on their footing and on not getting their hands cut off. As Philip watched the landscape ahead for attackers and obstacles, he saw something that he did not yet know would eventually qualify as both. They had not been in the Scapa all that long, but their slowed pace and the monotony of the landscape made it feel much longer. As they crested a low hill, just like the hundreds before, Philip saw in the distance, directly in their path, a mound of some sort that stood out from the others. In a landscape of gentle hills and equally gentle valleys, like a vast, two-dimensional sine wave, this one small bump seemed to erupt from the ground. It was one hill made of dirt in a sea of hills made of dirt, and yet it looked out of place. Philip told the others to stop for a moment. The others asked why. Philip explained,
"There's a hill."
Philip didn't blame them for not being impressed with his answer. He explained further,
"It's weird."
Again, Philip couldn't blame them for not being impressed. The others did stop, and he pointed out the offending pile of soil, and they finally agreed that it looked wrong. They all kept an eye on it as they walked. Thus, in a barren landscape with only one thing that made them nervous, the wizards walked directly toward that one thing. They were about 50 feet from the offending lump, and Philip was contemplating which side they should pass it on when the pile of dirt made the question moot by standing up. At first, Philip was the only one who saw the hill moving, as the others were preoccupied with carrying the Mobius blade. When the hill moved, Philip got startled and yelled and jumped a bit, which startled the others, making them jump quite a bit and yell at Philip. Then they saw what had startled Philip, and they all yelled at that. The mound had stirred, then lifted off the ground, supported by two short, thick columns of soil. Its central mass was a thick, bulbous lump of dirt and gravel that sprouted two gnarled arms and a flattened lump that approximated a head. Scrub grass, sagebrush, and formerly buried roots sprouted from the thing's surface like body hair. It stood 8 feet tall, much taller than any of the wizards, yet managed to seem short and stubby. The creature's eyes were defined by their absence. Two dark pits marked the place on the head where eyes would normally be. As it looked down at the wizards, they were given the contradictory impressions that they were being watched and that nobody was home. As the creature started to move, wispy clouds of dust rose from its joints, trailing behind it like a vapor trail as it lumbered toward the wizards. The beast started slow but was clearly picking up speed, and there were only about 50 feet between it and the wizards, who set a world speed record for carefully putting something down. The instant the Mobius blade was resting on the ground, they scattered. The creature pursued the nearest wizard, which in this case was Philip, who did the natural thing and kept running. When the others realized this, they stopped running and watched.
Seriously? A dirt monster?
Gary said, catching his breath. Tyler replied,
I'm guessing that's the elemental we were warned about. Earth is an element.
Philip's luxurious, full fur vest bounced with each step and flapped behind him as he fled from the elemental. The creature was hunched over, swinging its arms from side to side as it ran, leading with its flattened head and dead eyes. It had attained its top speed, which was surprisingly slow, but still slightly faster than Philip's top speed.
Run!
Jimmy shouted.
It's gaining on you!
Philip ventured a panicky glance over his shoulder at the thing chasing him.
Don't look at it!
Jimmy shouted.
Run!
Philip would have glared at Jimmy, but instead he tripped on some sagebrush and slid to a halt on his face. He scrambled back up to his feet just in time to have the elemental headbutt him with tremendous force between the shoulder blades, sending him flying and causing him to again slide to a stop on his face. The elemental had come to a dead stop, having imparted all of its momentum to Philip. It restarted its pursuit before Philip had even touched the ground, but the beast was not a sprinter, and Philip had enough time to roll to his right, operating mostly on instinct. After pushing off the ground, he brought up his arms to protect his head. His right upper arm collided with the elemental's wrist as the creature, unable to turn its bulk at speed, trundled past. Philip felt the impact and was sure it had done serious damage, but felt no pain. The elemental, being made of dirt, was not so fortunate. Its fist broke cleanly from its arm. When it hit the ground, the severed fist exploded into a cloud of dust and a pile of loose gravel and dirt. The elemental jogged to a halt and looked at the crumbling stump where its hand had been. It waddled to the spot where its hand had landed and disintegrated. The cloud of dust created when the severed hand impacted the ground had not dissipated, as one would expect, but had remained in place, and now seemed to actually become thicker and more tangible. Philip saw that individual grains of soil were lifting off the ground, as if supported by a strong wind that blew up out of the earth itself. By the time the elemental had reached the point of impact, all of the debris was airborne. It wafted toward the creature's shattered forearm and reformed into a fist as the beast watched with its dull, expressionless face. The elemental rotated its wrist and seemed satisfied. Clearly, it had no need of articulated fingers. Confirming that it was again fully functional, it turned its attention back to Philip, taking the first slow steps that would soon become a full gallop. Philip crawled backward, away from the creature, and felt a sudden jolt of blinding pain from his upper arm. He had not realized it was even injured before, but now he was sure it was broken. He rolled on his side, cradling his arm, which actually made it hurt worse. Looking down, past his broken arm and his flailing, kicking legs, Philip could see the dirt elemental coming his way, picking up speed. He knew that even if he did manage to regain his feet, he'd do it just in time to get knocked down again. His conscious mind didn't have enough time to come up with a plan. His animal instincts told him to roll into a ball and hope it would be over quickly. Philip decided to call that Plan B, and was starting to struggle to his feet when a Gary-shaped blur streaked into view, sword drawn, and hacked off one of the creature's arms. The dirt elemental skidded to a halt, showering the still-prone Philip with dust and gravel. Slowly, it turned its back on Philip, then walked over to the ruined remains of its severed arm. The few bits still recognizable as a former limb disintegrated into rubble, then drifted into the air. It reformed and consolidated back into a functional arm. The dirt elemental glanced at Philip, who was still trying to stand without jostling his arm. It looked as if it might just finish Philip off, but it was distracted by Gary, who was jumping up and down and shouting insults in an attempt to get the creature's attention. It worked. The creature looked at Gary, then started moving his way. Gary, naturally, fled. Gary ran in a wide curve, looping around toward Tyler and Jimmy. The creature followed. The creature was slightly faster than Gary in a straight line, but because of its much larger mass, it had a hard time managing turns, which slowed it down just enough for Gary to maintain his lead. When they saw that Gary was leading the creature back toward them, Tyler and Jimmy each ran in opposite directions, causing Gary, then the creature, to run between them, harmlessly.
"What are you doing?"
Tyler asked as Gary ran past.
"I'm bringing it over here so you can get it off of me,"
Gary shouted.
"That's no good,"
Tyler yelled to the now distant Gary, who was still leading the creature in a wide arc.
"Why not?"
"Because then it'd be chasing me,"
Tyler replied. Jimmy added,
"Yeah, then I'd have to get it off him, and you'd have to get it off me. It's not a long-term solution."
Gary's cursing sounded distant and weak to Jimmy and Tyler. Philip had made it to his feet by this time and was slowly walking toward them. He looked pale and shaken. Tyler told him to stay on his feet just in case, but to keep his distance until they figured out what to do with the dirt monster. Jimmy watched a moment, then said, in a distracted voice,
"It's just chasing him. He's not trying to cut him off or throw anything at him. It's just chasing."
Tyler nodded.
"You're surprised it's not very bright? It was made by Todd. How smart can it be?"
Jimmy drew his sword and glanced at Tyler, who glanced back and drew his own sword. Jimmy nodded, then called out to Gary.
"Okay, we're ready this time. Lead him back here and run between us."
Gary didn't say anything, but he immediately changed course, turning sharply toward Tyler and Jimmy. The elemental was not able to turn as sharply and swung wide behind Gary, like a water skier slewing out behind the towboat. Gary made a beeline for Tyler and Jimmy. The creature continued making a beeline for Gary. Tyler and Jimmy stood motionless as Gary ran between them. As expected, the beast paid them no attention, continuing to home in on Gary. As it went past, Jimmy and Tyler both swung their swords. If they had been more coordinated as a team, they might have discussed whether they should swing for different parts of the creature's anatomy. But they weren't, so they both swung for the legs, neatly severing them from the elemental's torso. The legs fell and tumbled and shattered as they hit the ground. The torso, arms, and head continued to move forward, carried by their own momentum. The creature swung its arms wildly, as if trying to regain its balance, but it had no legs to balance on. What served as the dirt elemental's pelvis hit the ground first and crumbled into nothing as the mass of the creature's torso rolled forward. After a bit more flailing and rolling, all that was left was a mess and a cloud of dust, which really is all there ever was to begin with. Tyler and Jimmy stood, looking down at their handiwork. Gary jogged up to join them.
"Good work, guys," Gary said. "Your plan worked."
"Plan?"
Tyler asked.
That wasn't the plan. That was improvising. The plan was to knock you down and see if the elemental would trip over you. But I lost my nerve.
They shared a chuckle, but it was short-lived. Nobody had to point out that the dust cloud was not dissipating. Soon, it was again coalescing into the familiar form of the dirt elemental, lying face down on the ground. Tyler looked to Philip, who was still a good distance away. Tyler held up a hand, telling Philip to keep his distance. Philip did not need to be told this. The elemental slowly lifted itself to its feet. It did not speak, but its body language said that it was not happy. Jimmy, Tyler, and Gary took off running in three different directions, forcing the creature to decide which of them to chase. It chose Jimmy. Jimmy looked back over his shoulder and yelled, "See, Gary, a short-term solution!" Tyler sprinted to the top of the nearest mound, hoping he could see something, anything that might be of use. If not, they'd let the elemental chase Jimmy for a minute or so, chop it to bits, and start the whole process over again. Tyler shielded his eyes with his hand and muttered,
"Thought I saw as we walked here."
Tyler saw what he was looking for and yelled,
"Jimmy! Jimmy!"
When he was sure Jimmy was looking his way, he pointed back the way they'd come from and yelled,
"Puddle!"
Jimmy ran the direction Tyler had indicated, as did Tyler and Gary. They didn't know what would happen, but they wanted to see it. Tyler tried to guide Jimmy toward the puddle, yelling,
"Left! More to your left! No, not that far, right!"
Jimmy missed the puddle, but got close enough to get a good look. It was large for a puddle, but far too small to be a pond. It was a 10-foot-wide, amorphous blob of filthy-looking water that had either burbled up from the sickly ground or had fallen in the last rain and refused to penetrate any farther into this awful piece of land. It was surrounded by a 3-foot moat of gummy-looking mud. Jimmy was glad he'd missed it, because he was half sure that if he'd set 1 foot in the actual moistened area of the puddle, he'd have come to an instant stop and been helpless to escape from the dirt elemental. When Jimmy was beyond the puddle, he made a quick 45-degree turn in the direction of the puddle. He thought that if he was lucky, the elemental would try to cut the corner and get stuck in the mud. He didn't dare slow down to look, but he didn't have to. Tyler and Gary's disappointed groans told him he had not been successful. He cursed himself, remembering that the stupid creature cornered like a tank. Expecting it to suddenly cut a corner more sharply than he had was a silly mistake. Jimmy ran as fast as he could in a straight line for a bit, then turned widely and lined up on a direct path for the puddle. He deliberately slowed, allowing the creature to close the gap. Jimmy ran as near as he dared to the mud bordering the puddle, then dodged to the left. He heard a splash, and Tyler and Gary cheering, and saw a lump of mud about the size of a watermelon fly past him to his right and splatter on the ground. As Jimmy slid to a stop, a second lump fell to the ground from a much higher, slower trajectory. Jimmy turned, hoping to see the monster stuck in the mud, and was disappointed. The elemental had made it to the other side of the puddle and was down on its hands and knees, as if it had simply tripped on its way through the puddle, and now would get up, angrier than before. Jimmy couldn't figure out why Tyler and Gary sounded so happy. Even Philip seemed to be yelling congratulations while sitting on the ground, cradling his injured arm. It was only when the elemental tried to get to its feet again and failed that Jimmy realized why everyone was so delighted. The beast would not be able to get back on his feet because the two large blobs of mud that had gone flying were its feet. Clearly, they had quickly soaked up water on contact, then had become heavy enough to go flying when the beast kicked its feet forward to take a step. Jimmy's eyes darted to the nearest foot, now just a blob of dark, wet mud on the ground. Jimmy expected to see it crumbling apart and drifting toward the dirt elemental, ready to resume its duties as a foot. Instead, he saw the blob of mud stirring slightly and spreading out as it settled.
"It can't reform!" he yelled to the others. "The mud is too heavy! Lead it back into the puddle!"
The elemental was crawling toward Jimmy. Tyler sprinted toward it and used his sword to hack off one of the creature's arms, causing it to do an undignified faceplant. Of course, the creature's arm was bone dry and took little time to reattach itself to the beast's torso, but the object was to get the creature's attention. Tyler had accomplished that handily. The elemental turned away from Jimmy and crawled away in pursuit of Tyler, who had run around to the far side of the puddle. Later, when they discussed the day's events, they would theorize that the dry earth that made up the elemental's body was very loosely packed, and thus the normal capillary action that drew the moisture up into the mass of dirt was accelerated. Whatever the cause, when the creature's right hand went into the puddle, the dirt that constituted its arm immediately darkened all the way past its elbow. The left hand followed the right hand into the water, then the right was lifted to reach forward and continue crawling toward Tyler. As the right arm pitched forward, the sodden blob that had been the creature's hand flew straight up in the air and landed next to the creature, making a large, muddy splash. The creature pondered the soggy stump where its right hand had been. Then its left hand, still submerged in the foot-deep puddle, disintegrated. Since one-third of the creature's weight was resting on a hand that now no longer existed, the dirt elemental fell face first into the water. All of the still exposed parts of the dirt elemental darkened and softened. It rolled onto its back, revealing the damage the moisture had done. It thrashed with its mangled limbs, flinging bits of itself all over the countryside as it struggled to get free. Eventually it stopped trying to get out of the puddle because it had become the puddle. What had been a still body of fetid liquid was now a viscous slick of dark, gummy mud. The force that allowed the creature to reform when dry was strong enough to keep the mud bubbling and churning, but did not seem strong enough to let it rise and be a threat again. Gary crouched next to the edge of the mud patch, stuck the end of his sword in the mud, and said, "Whatever particulate matter simulation he was using to make it clearly wasn't calibrated for the weight of the mud. Just loose, dry dirt. I don't think it's going to give us any more trouble." A tendril of mud started to climb Gary's sword, making its way toward his hand with surprising speed. Gary shrieked and jerked the sword out of the mud, flinging bits of muck far away. The beast was dispersed and subdued, but it wasn't dead. It was only a matter of time before it reformed. After he'd composed himself, Gary said, "All the same, I think we should keep moving." Before they could move on, there was the issue of Philip's arm. There was no doubt in anyone's mind that it was broken. The question was, how badly? They looked at the affected region. They poked at it and listened to the volume and ferocity of Philip's complaints. Then, falling back on all of their combined experience in the medical profession, none. They determined that it was a clean break in one place. They hoped. They asked Philip if it hurt. He said, "Yes!" which did not surprise them. Philip asked if there was anything they could do for the pain. They said, "No," which did not surprise him. In the end, they cut some excess fur from the hem of Philip's increasingly ratty mink coat and made him the world's most glamorous sling. Normally this would have been difficult, since every genuine fur coat is also a leather coat, and leather isn't famous for being easy to cut. Luckily, they had the Mobius blade, which sliced through the leather as if it were tissue paper.
"Glad the Mobius blade is so sharp," Tyler said,
quickly following with,
"Man, there's a sentence I didn't expect to say."
Jimmy said, "I don't think it's possible for a blade to be this sharp on its own. I'm betting he used the file to alter the edge. Maybe the molecules along the edge instantly sever certain bonds in any other molecules they touch. Todd has played around with that kind of thing before."
"Really? When?"
Tyler asked.
"Before he came to us. I found out all about it while I was working my way back. He killed a man by negating all of the molecular bonds in his body, reduced him to a puddle of goo. The mess was horrendous. That's how I think the blade works. Even if I'm wrong, it's a pretty good idea. We should remember it for when we get out of this."
From thin air, somewhere above them, Todd's voice called out,
"Good guess, Merlin. Sorry, you go by Jimmy these days. Anyway, right on the nose. Glad you approve. It took a lot of tweaking to get it right. At first, it affected any molecules it touched, so the blade kept tearing itself apart. I made the effect directional. It only cuts things that hit it head-on, which fixed the cutting itself to bits problem, but then I found that if I dropped the prototype just right, it would cut all the way to the center of the Earth.
How'd you learn that?
I dropped it just right and it cut all the way to the center of the Earth. At least, I assume so. The hole closed itself back up. Anyway, I see what you mean. It might be useful for you.
Todd laughed.
When you get out of this. Especially Philip. He looks great.
Philip told Todd what he thought of his opinion, but Todd had either left or decided not to answer. They fitted Philip's new fur sling. Then Jimmy helped Philip to his feet, saying,
All right, Philip. Upsy-daisy. We'll handle carrying the blade. You just take the lead and keep an eye out for wolves.
Philip asked Tyler and Gary if they agreed. They did, vigorously. He shrugged, winced in pain, then watched while the others lifted the Mobius blade. When they had the blade in hand, Philip resumed the path to the chasm of certain doom. The others followed. Tyler and Jimmy exchanged an uncertain look.
Hey, Gary said. What was that?
Tyler said,
What?
What was that look? Gary asked.
Nothing,
Tyler said.
There was no look.
Shut up.
Without turning or even slowing down, Philip said,
Don't worry about it, Gary. It just meant that Jimmy and Tyler aren't sure how long I'm going to last with a broken arm.
Oh,
Gary said.
Okay.
25.
Break!
Roy bellowed.
I'm breaking! I'm breaking!
Martin called back, pulling with all of his weight on the metal bar that now protruded through the bed of the cart, just in front of the rear axle. Martin pulled hard on the bar, bracing his feet on the rear wall of the cart's bed and hanging off the back of the cart in his desperation to slow it down. Sparks showered the sides of the path as the metal rims of the rear wheels ground against the metal pads on Roy's improved brakes. Martin knew that if his hand slipped or the bar broke, he'd fall backward into the cart's wake and watch, helplessly choking on dust, as the cart careened away without any brakes, save for the emergency brake Britt, Roy, and Gwen had cooked up. They'd explained how it worked to him. He suspected falling backward out of the cart was the safer option. At the front of the cart, Roy had both hands full, wrestling the tiller he had connected to the front wheels. Modern people are accustomed to vehicles with power, or at least rack and pinion steering. This cart was never designed to be steered from the driver's seat, and the basic geometry of the axle put Roy at a mechanical disadvantage. Roy stopped shouting for more brakes while he guided the cart around a turn, barely managing to keep all four wheels on the ground. The path ahead was fairly straight, so he ventured a look at his passengers. Gwen and Britt were in the middle of the cart, between the driver's bench and the brakeman's position. They were both holding on to the sides of the cart, crouched as if prepared to jump over the side at the slightest provocation, but moving only when necessary to either shift their weight to the inside of a corner or to dodge any of the loose items rolling around in the back of the cart. It had been decided that they should bring along some tools and lumber to repair the cart should it break before they ran out of hill. They had stacked their supplies carefully in the center of the bed, an arrangement that had lasted until the first sharp turn. Both Gwen and Britt were wide-eyed, their mouths agape. Somehow, even with the wind and the rattling and the grinding drowning them out, Roy could tell that Gwen was screaming, but Britt was laughing.
How are you two doing?
He asked. Gwen shrieked,
I'm terrified!
Fear means you're making progress!
Roy yelled. Roy turned back to the path ahead, just in time to almost not make the next turn.
Relax,
Britt said, between laughing jags.
We aren't really going that fast. I think we're doing something like 20 miles an hour. It just feels much faster because the vehicle is fundamentally unsound. Why didn't you say so to begin with?
Gwen asked.
Say what?
Britt asked.
That the vehicle was unsound? I did. All three of us did. We discussed at length that we'd have to try to keep things slow and be ready to bail out because this cart was never designed to be used this way. You just weren't there. You were outside, working on the emergency brake.
When Britt had proposed her idea for the last-ditch emergency break, Roy had actually laughed out loud, not because it was ridiculous, but because there was no reason it couldn't work, despite being ridiculous. He and Britt brainstormed the elements necessary to make it work and determined that the handiwork of someone who knew how to work with fabric was called for. Gwen took the sewing kit Britt the Elder had sent, Roy's trench coat for material, and some general instructions for what she would make. Then she found a quiet, pleasant spot under a tree to do her work. As such, she had not been privy to any of the later design conversations. At one point, Britt had decided to take a break from the hammering and the bending and Martin's incessant humming of the theme from the A-Team to check on Gwen's progress.
"How's it going?"
Britt asked, sitting on the shady ground next to Gwen.
"Well, I think,"
Gwen answered. Britt nodded.
"Will it work? The emergency break?"
Gwen asked.
"Yeah, I think it might. If we're going straight. If we're turning, no way."
"Yeah," Britt said.
"That is one design flaw, but it's better than nothing."
Gwen said,
"The good news is that this old trench coat is made out of good, strong material. It was a shame to cut it up.
At least he has the coat Britt the Elder sent for him, so he'll stay warm and dry. We'll get Roy a new trench coat when this is all over. You can make him one if you want, or we could just zip back to the 21st century and buy him one."
Gwen shook her head.
"No, we'll want to go to the 20th century. Better craftsmanship then."
"Ah, yes," Britt said. "Those skilled lady seamstresses with their nimble little woman hands."
Gwen chuckled lightly.
"He's getting better. He's still kind of weird around us, but he's treating us like useful members of the team now."
Britt smiled.
"I knew he'd come around eventually. The smart ones usually do."
"I suppose. I just wish he would relax,"
Gwen said, squinting at her stitching.
"Well,"
Britt sighed,
"the awkwardness is partly our fault."
Gwen looked up from her sewing and squinted at Britt.
"Not women in general," Britt clarified. "Us, specifically, and in this one situation."
Britt could tell by the continued intensity of Gwen's squint that more clarification was needed.
"I'm just saying that I think, in the long run, Atlantis might have been a mistake. It made sense at the time. Early history was generally hostile toward women, more so the further back you went. Adding magical powers to the mix certainly didn't simplify things. When we started traveling through time, it seemed smart to create a separate place where women could go to be in charge of their own destinies and be treated with the respect they deserved."
"Made sense to me,"
Gwen said.
"That's why I moved there."
Britt said,
"Yeah, but I think you had it right the first time when you were living among the male time travelers, interacting with them, proving your worth. I made Atlantis. It was my idea, and it was constructed by Britt the Elder, who is me, probably. Anyway, by keeping women separate from men, I've doomed women to being non-players in the men's stories. The male wizards can't see women as their equals, because they never really interact with women who are their equals, aside from the very rare woman of equal or greater status who gets involved."
"Like you and me,"
Gwen said.
"Exactly. It's no wonder they treat strong, independent women as oddities. We are oddities in their world, and I'm the one who made it that way. It wasn't my intention, but that's what happened."
Gwen thought about this for a moment, then said,
"Okay, say you're right. What do we do about it?"
Britt said,
"Well, we can't fix the past."
"We are time travelers,"
Gwen reminded her.
"Yes, and as you've seen, all that really means is that we can mess up the past, not fix it."
"True. We can't fix the past, but we can improve things going forward. I'm going to make sure that the sorceresses of Atlantis mix and integrate with the other wizard communities in the future. And I'm going to try to remember this lesson and not make the same mistake again."
"Should you find yourself in a position to create another society from your imagination again?"
Gwen said.
"Yeah,"
Britt said.
"If it comes up."
In the distance, Martin emerged from the blacksmith shop and called out,
"Hey, guys, if you got a sec, Roy and I would like your opinion about something."
Britt and Gwen listened to Roy and Martin's disagreement and offered their opinions. Discussion ensued, and consensus was reached. This process was repeated many times. They all worked hard, the men doing more than half of the grunt labor, and the women doing more than half of the irritating, fiddly work. When it was done, they rested. The next morning they set out in the cart, which they'd heavily modified into what was possibly the world's first four-person, all-terrain, soapbox derby car. It was almost certainly a mistake, but it was a mistake they'd made together. The cart rattled down the winding path. They were moving fast, fast enough to feel that they'd be seriously injured if the cart fell apart, but slow enough that they all doubted whether they'd catch up to the others before that happened. Roy yelled to his passengers, "Lean right!" and threw the tiller all the way to the left, slamming the cart into a hard right turn. Gwen, who was sitting on the right side of the cart to begin with, pushed her weight into the side of the cart's bed as hard as she dared, fearing that the ancient wood might fail to support her weight. Britt scurried from her position in the left side of the bed to Gwen's side, using her body weight as ballast to help keep the inside wheels of the cart on the ground as they maneuvered through the turn. Martin was putting most of his weight into the brake lever. His feet lost traction as they careened around the corner, causing him to fall out the back of the cart. He still had a firm grip on the brake handle, and now that his full weight was bearing down on the lever, the cart's speed slowed noticeably. They were really designed to be parking brakes, not to slow a vehicle already in motion. Roy and Britt had beefed them up as well as they could, but they all knew the brakes wouldn't last forever. Roy yelled, "Good work!" while Martin struggled to get his feet back into the cart. Looking down at his sneakers as they scrambled against the back of the cart, a sudden streak of gray in his peripheral vision caught Martin's attention. Once he got both feet back on the cart, he ventured a quick look at the path behind and saw that there were four wolves chasing them. He quickly theorized that they must have spawned at the same speed they would if the group walked by, but since they were rolling past at many times their walking speed, the wolves didn't really spring into action until the cart was well past. That meant that the longer they rolled down this hill, the more wolves would gather behind them, and the more important it would be to keep rolling. Martin saw that the wolves were gaining on them. He eased off the brakes. They were out of the turn and back on a relatively straight bit of path. Britt crawled back to her side of the cart.
"At this rate," she yelled to anyone who was listening, "we should catch up to the others in no time."
"Hell," Roy said, "I half expect to crash into them."
26. Philip had always been a morning person, but Todd's quest was helping him get over that. It had shown him that what he had always perceived as the promise of a new day could also be taken as a threat. Philip sat up, grudgingly admitting to himself that he was awake. The night air had been frigid. The ground was lumpy with rocks. His bedroll and all the bits of him that were exposed were covered with cold, clammy dew, part of the Scapa's ongoing attempt to give life just enough of a foothold to keep suffering. His arm hurt like hell. There was no denying that. This had been his first attempt to sleep with his arm broken and in a sling, and it had not gone well. He would have been willing to bet that he hadn't slept at all, if not for two things. He did not remember seeing the sunrise, and somehow the pen with the note wrapped around it had found its way into his sling without him knowing it. Taking care not to look down at the note, Philip mimed using his good hand to adjust his sling while slowly unrolling the note into the hand of his broken arm. It had all of the hastily scribbled messages he'd remembered. At the bottom, in Jimmy's neat script, there was the single word, "over," and an arrow. Philip flipped the scrap of paper over, rolled his eyes, and read Jimmy's contribution.
"Gentlemen, I'm sure you know the game Rock, Paper, Scissors. Two players each pick whether to play rock, paper, or scissors, as each choice beats one of the others and is beaten by the third. People think it's a game of chance, but they're wrong. The key to winning is to get good at predicting what your opponent is likely to choose. Todd thinks he's clever, but he isn't. Someone who makes no pretense at being clever will just do what you expect them to do. Someone who's truly clever is unpredictable. Someone who thinks they're clever will do the opposite of what you expect them to do. Also, in rock, paper, scissors, if you watch your opponent's hand, they'll often make their hand signal a fraction of a second before they should, giving you the advantage. Todd wants to kill us, but he thinks he's clever, so he'll try to do it cleverly. So he'll try to trick us into killing ourselves. I say, our best plan is to keep our eyes open for him to tip his hand, and if he tells us to do something, we do the opposite. Jay.
Philip looked up from the note, grimacing.
Brilliant, he thought. Keep our eyes open and don't do what he tells us. We certainly...